This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics. And just when we were hearing that Prime Minister Mark Carney was in the process of getting rid of most of the Trudeau-era ministers, he taps the ultimate Trudeau buddy, Mark Miller, who was left out of initial cabinet appointments, to be his culture minister. So what's behind this? Does Carney need help in Quebec that he thinks Mark Miller can give him? And it looks like Joel Lightbound is the rising star from La Belle Province after getting tough with Canada Post. And what about Carney himself? The polls indicate that Canadians are continuing to give him a lot of leeway, despite not getting anywhere on the trade file and not handling it the way he ran his campaign on. Well, now Algoma Steel is laying off 1,000 workers. This after Carney promised specifically to protect steel workers, and he has not followed through at all. So will there be a political price? And we've had yet another non-announcement on the Eglinton crosstown. I can't figure out why they keep doing that. And the Ontario Attorney General is slamming the Ford government on health care for failing to get more people a family doctor and failing to oversee OHIP billings. As you heard in Jeremy's news, 59 physicians billed for more than 24 hours a day. And I hope that they're better at medicine than math. Let's the numbers 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, the Recovering Politicians Panel.
And now I'd like to welcome George Smitherman, a former Liberal Deputy Premier and Health Minister, Lisa Raitt, a Deputy Leader of the Conservative Party, a former Deputy Leader of the Conservative Party, and Peggy Nash, former NDP MP for Parkdale High Park. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Libby.
Hi, everyone.
Hi. So let's begin with this appointment of Mark Miller. I mean, he was very conspicuously left out of previous cabinet shuffles, and now he's in, albeit in not exactly a critical portfolio. George, what do you think is behind that?
Thriving desire for competency. I really think, like, I do understand the narrative is like, oh, it's a step back to Trudeau. But anybody that thinks this is the Trudeau government anymore, I think, is a little bit lost in some of the policy evolutions. And I've never met Mark Miller, but from a distance, I really frankly admired him as the cream of the crop in terms of performance of ministers. I know that maybe not everyone will share that, but I think he's quite a competent individual that he communicates, I think, very, very directly. And I think he'll be in a benefit to the government.
Lisa, do you agree?
So I look at the list of Quebec MPs. There's a lot of good people there who could equally do the job. Jean-Yves Duclos, who was also a cabinet minister, could have easily fit in. So I think there's a lot to be said about the fact that Mark Miller represents more of the left of the Liberal Party than other Liberal MPs are. And I think they're trying to make sure that there's a signal to the rest of the MPs who are more on the environmental side of it, that they are, that the Carney government is listening and that putting representation in the cabinet. I think the substitution for Mr. Guilbeault was to bring in somebody who was close to the environmental side of the Liberal Party, and that's what they're getting in Mark Miller.
And do you see Joel Lightbound, who most people are not that familiar with yet, he seems to be the rising star, and he was first on the radar for getting tough with Canada Post.
Yeah, so I know Joel. I know him from, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting Peggy there, but I do know Joel. We sat on committees together. He took a really hard stance against the Liberal government, his own government, going into the last election. He criticized them heavily. He speaks his own mind. He's well-liked in Quebec. I like this appointment, quite frankly, of him. I think it's a good sign. He's a Carney person. He's not a Trudeau person.
And is he Francophone or Anglo?
Very much so,
Francophone.
Yeah.
Francophone. Peggy, what's your take on all of this? Are you happy to see a nod to the Trudeau left in the Mark Carney government?
Well, I think Prime Minister Carney was facing pushback, obviously, from the former Trudeau team in government and his base. And it's the Liberal Party really trying to straddle that middle where you have more liberal conservative people and more liberal left people. And I think he's trying to do both. Joel Lightbound is, I would say, more on the conservative side. He is in an area of Quebec City, which is more conservative, a more conservative part of Quebec, whereas Mark Miller, as you said, is more on the progressive side. And he is in an area, i.e. Montreal, which is a more progressive part of the province. So I think he's trying to balance both parts of the party and diffuse some of the criticism he has faced about abandoning his commitments to the environment.
Lisa, I'm wondering, so we've talked a lot about how Carney campaigned elbows up. Actually, his elbows are down. He promised a trade deal by July. That is not happening. And he also very specifically promised to protect our steel industry and our steel workers. And clearly, that's not happening. These big layoffs by Algoma announced yesterday, 1,000. Is Carney, is he ever going to have to pay a political price for that?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, the problem that the Prime Minister faces, first of all, let's be honest and say that I don't know how you defend against Donald Trump coming after your steel industry, your automotive industry, and your aluminum industry. This is a really tough set of facts for Mr. Carney. If I would be critical, though, is he actually built up our expectations in the country that this was going to be okay. Even last week, he said, when he was asked about what was going on with Donald Trump, he said, he don't care, there's nothing burning I have to talk to him about. Boom, 1,000 layoffs at Algoma. So the Prime Minister and his team, who are working very hard, I know they are, I've spoken to them. The reality is that they also have to level with Canadians what's going on. But that does not help you when you're trying to keep a minority government going, because bad news is something that MPs don't like giving to their constituents, so they're going to get a lot more problems at home over the winter. But you know, the band-aid is off right now. Algoma is definitely a sign to a lot of people in the country that it does matter. We need a deal with the United States, and you got to get back to the table some way or somehow. The concept that no deal is better than having a deal in general is starting to slip away. He needs a better talking point.
Benefited from possibly high expectations, and that helped him get elected. But that is a drag now on his leadership. And it's not, I mean, steel, 50% tariffs, how do you protect against that? I mean, the government has invested in Algoma, which I think is important. What they maybe should have done was had strings attached to make sure that any layoffs were deferred absolutely as long as possible. I mean, this is the worst possible news for these 1,000 families right before the holidays. And I don't think there were those strings attached, which gave the government a bit of a window in terms of the in terms of Algoma's decisions. I think that, you know, and it, obviously there's going to be some impact here when you've got a 50% tariff, but the company benefits by having as much time as possible to adjust. And they, it seems like they ran out of runway, but the government needed to have a lever to push them to keep people on absolutely as long as possible. And not to mention the weakness of our EI program. I mean, these workers are going to be out with a very weak employment insurance plan, and that needs to be beefed up.
Well, there never seems to be those levers. We keep finding out about corporations who get big bucks, make promises, and then decamp, George. And I don't know, how do you explain the polls show that Canadians have a lot of patience for this?
I think that the polls show that Canadians have figured it out, just like Peggy and Lisa have, which is even if we want to lay a criticism on the prime minister, everybody can see what he's up against in terms of the volatility of Trump. And I do think with respect to this elbows up thing that you like to run with, you know, Canada is fighting not just for these sectoral arrangements, but also for an extension of a trade arrangement that provides tariff-free access for a tremendous array of Canadian products. Look what Europe did. They accepted 15% across the board in like a second, et cetera. So I do think Canada's fighting it out for the long term. With respect to Algoma Steel, that place has been was central to my family's economic progress because my dad's trucking company was the house carrier there. So it's a really special spot to me. Mm-hmm. These layoffs were coming anyway because they're making an enormously important shift to an electric arc furnace. And I think that the point's been made here that we need to do everything to support the workers whose livelihood is interrupted. But I think the government of Canada has done the right thing to make dollars available to Algoma Steel so that even in these incredibly uncertain and challenging times, they can make the transition to being world leading in terms of the green nature of their steel, which will be an extraordinarily important point of differentiation on the long term. I just think Canadians have figured a lot of this stuff out. Like, we can all want to be at the table with Trump, but like, that's a little harder sometimes to pull off than we all might prefer, because it's a bit of a, you know, anyway, I won't characterize it further.
Lisa, have Canadians figured it out, or have they not figured it out yet? I mean, I'm just wondering that with it seems to be a stack of promises broken, and when is that going to show in the polls?
Well, the polls have tightened. I mean, if you take a look at some recent ones that came out in the last week, conservatives are 2 to 3 points behind. In one case, they were tied. But the only poll that matters is on election day. The question is, who is going to push them into an election? Clearly, conservatives didn't want to do it on the budget. And we've got to get through a Budget Implementation Act passing, and we'll see what's going to end up happening there. But nobody wants an election right now. And that's all parties. So relevant of whether or not Mr. Carney is going to be liked or not liked, the reality is that unless there's an election, it's not going to necessarily matter. Let's see what the spring brings, to be honest. Let's see how tough the winter is.
Let's see if Polyev does anything to close the gap on leadership and negotiation with trust, because party polling is one thing. But if the question to be put in an election is, which of these people do you think would be Canada to be better served by dealing with these all these foreign governments? So far, the answer hasn't been Polyev. Maybe his convention moment will give him a lift in the same way that Merritt Stiles' convention moment seems to have given her a little bit of new life.
Yeah, I don't know how long that's lasting. Peggy, we just saw the Auditor General of Ontario release her report. It's pretty scathing against the Ford government in terms of keeping track of billing and also helping people find a family doctor, which is something that the government has actually been crowing about, saying, look what we've done.
You know, as a Torontonian, I have to say, it seems that Premier Ford is so busy trying to be the mayor of Toronto that he seems to have turned his back on a lot of the operations in the province of Ontario, whether it's the real estate agency that was supposed to oversee, regulate real estate, whether it's our environment. There are so many things that he should be engaged in. But I think the biggest one of all is our healthcare system. And it is shocking that the auditor is saying there could be up to $1 billion that is involved in overpayments because nobody is minding the store. That is shocking. Anybody who's waited hours and hours in an emergency ward, anybody without a family doctor, anybody waiting months and months for an MRI or surgery, I think should be outraged by this. And if, you know, the job one of the government is to be a good manager and make sure services are effectively delivered. So rather than fantasizing about a tunnel under the 401, why doesn't Doug Ford make his big project the actual good functioning of our healthcare system? That would be the big investment, the big build that he could do for the people of Ontario.
Lisa, I mean, what do you think? I'm also, when I look at OHIP and oversight, that seems like the domain of bureaucrats and not political staff.
True, but the buck stops with the politician. And, you know, whenever Auditor General reports came out, when I was a minister, you would say that we'll study them, we'll take a look at them, and we'll try to do better. But these are tools for the public to take a look at and see whether or not politicians are managing their dollars appropriately. And that's, as a conservative, that's my sweet spot, you know, criticizing a government for not managing their team appropriately so that they can deliver for services. And the one place where you do not want to see people saying that dollars are being wasted or diverted from actual care, boy, that is the healthcare system.
Because
you would think that their software or something would alert them if people are billing for more than 24 hours a day.
This is a system that works on fax machines, Libby.
Yeah, that's
so
true too.
Out of date. Oh my God.
I have a little expertise on this subject.
Yes, you
and
do.
I just put this one thing into the mix. No one likes to hear about waste, but there's a very limited appetite amongst Ontarians to hear that their own doctor is being persecuted for their billings. So back in the day, I had a Supreme Court justice retire, give us advice. And I think it was on a unanimous vote in the legislature that we did reduce some of the oversights on billings for doctors. But I just assure you that there's a really strong sentiment where people love their doctors so much, they're sometimes unprepared that any of them might get up to mischief. And the second thing I would say, there's around 1% of all the billings that take place that are a real madhouse, where it takes months to settle them, et cetera. And there is room for improvement and investment there, but the public really takes the side of their doctors in any of these seeming squabbles over billings.
Wow, that's...
You know, it's like people don't like politicians, but they often like their local person. Yeah. I think same with doctors. It drives people crazy that there is waste, inefficiency, or just lack of oversight in healthcare. I have a doctor. I'm one of the lucky ones. Do I think she does a good job? Yes. But I think she would probably agree that if there are some bad apples overbilling or there's just general lack of oversight, boy, that hurts everybody.
And the other thing, George, back to you, since you do have some experience of this. So the government does seem to be tackling the huge challenge of finding people, family doctors, but they release the information in little dribs and drabs, right? So it's very hard to put it all together. And the Auditor General said, sorry, you're not doing a quick enough or a good enough job on that. So given your experience, what do you think of that?
Well, I'm in the business of physician recruiting. I'm doing that right now primarily by bringing doctors from the UK, US, and South Africa. And it's heavy lifting. The government has made a lot of commitment to primary care and to the idea that everybody can have a doctor. And they are earnestly making efforts to get people that are on Healthcare Connect, which is the place to go if you need a doctor, Healthcare Connect. They're really working through those lists and trying to get doctors and teams to roster up more people. I give them credit for that. But what they're up against, they're kind of like swimming upriver with a really, really strong current. The current of demographics, which is both means there's a lot of older doctors and there's a hell of a ton of older Ontarians, and there's more and more by the day. And you folks know that better than others. And there's other demographic trends like people living longer and therefore having much more underlying complexity with chronic disease, et cetera. So there's these twin tsunamis of demographic tsunamis, which really make progress very, very difficult to achieve. But they have resourced the initiative for family doctors. Like they have put real new money there, but it's very hard to mint a new doctor immediately.
Well, exactly. And Lisa, I mean, one of the criticisms was that the list on Healthcare Connect doesn't reflect the true picture. But I mean, you know, whose fault is it if people who need a doctor aren't going on to Healthcare Connect? If I needed a doctor, I mean, I would be all over everything and just sort of see what I got.
Yeah, that's true. I guess, you know, it's you don't know what you need until you're faced with a situation where you need it right away. And this is the, you know, I'm glad George is doing what he's doing, you know, to try to help everybody in the province with respect to it. There's a whole lot of problems, though, with the way that in which the system is working. I know it's sad to rail against the system, but the sheer amount of paperwork that is foisted upon our family doctors, for example, actually decreases the amount of time that they can provide in terms of providing care to patients. If you decrease paperwork and time for that, maybe you're going to decrease or you're going to increase the amount of time, amount of patients that they can take on. And maybe the two should be linked to one another, quite frankly, so that you don't have a situation where there's an artificial kind of ceiling given of how many patients somebody wants to take.
Oh, I talk to people all the time about the administrative challenges, and you'd think that there would be at least partially a technological solution or a solution with people who are not doctors doing some of that administrative work. But, you know, we
the
have yet.
ODSP form that a doctor receives for a person trying to go on to ODSP is 13 pages long. The new Canadian disability credit requires quite a lot of doctors,
yeah,
because they were the gatekeeper and they were in that trusted role that they got so much of this piled up on them. And one thing that the Ford government is doing as of April 1st is starting to offer some hourly compensation to the doctors for that administrative workload. So it's a step in the right direction, but we keep asking assignments of them, doctor's notes and X and Y and Z. And that gatekeeper effect is really what loads up a lot of the administrative burden.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely bonkers, I think. It's really, there are things there that really you should not have your doctor doing, right? And probably an admin person would be better at some of it. I mean, I know it's that crazy talk. But yeah,
I think if I could just throw in just one last comment, I think, you know, governments have been putting more money into healthcare But our population has been growing. Inflation has been rising, even though it's moderating somewhat now. So that means that mostly governments have been treading water in and not making the changes that we need. I think, yes, there are some procedural and technological changes that could help a lot. But healthcare costs are mostly people costs. And unless we are training enough of the right professionals to take on the right jobs, and yes, we shouldn't have physicians filling out a lot of paperwork. Surely they can just sign off on something that is prepared for them in their office by a technician. I think we need to actually reform how healthcare is delivered. And that's a bigger job. And I really hope it's one that the government will tackle.
Well, they say they are. And just to wrap things up, you know, I have a medical panel we talk to all the time. There's a lot of inefficiency. And you know, it's not just money that's going to fix this. But it's a huge beast to move. Anyway, thank you so much for that. By the way, people, we will be following up more on that Auditor General report tomorrow. And tomorrow's also our medical record day. But in the meantime, thank you to our recovering politicians, Lisa Raitt, George Smitherman, and Peggy Nash. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Thanks, Libby.
Okay, we are taking a break. When we come back, it's Giving Tuesday. I bet everybody knows, because if you're like me, you have been inundated, like absolutely inundated by asks. I couldn't even count the number in my inbox. We'll talk about it when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, it is Giving Tuesday, and the theory is that after buying gifts for your family and friends and yourself, it's time to give back to your community. And I'm guessing that most of you are experiencing what I am, which is being completely inundated with charity marketing. I cannot even count the emails in my inbox today. And to be honest, I feel like I've already spent way too much energy trying to figure out which deals are good on Black Friday and Cyber Monday and all the rest of it. And it looks like, to me, I don't know if this is peak Giving Tuesday, but the charities are taking much the same marketing approach as the retailers are. And so I want to drill down on that a little bit. Giving Tuesday only started back in 2012. In the meantime, so let me hear from you. What do you think? Are you going to be making a donation today on Giving Tuesday? Have you chosen where you're going to donate and why? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740. Toll free, 1-866-740-4740. And in the meantime, I have some very good news about our Zoomer Radiothon, which is ending as Giving Tuesday begins, and it has topped $80,000, which is a record. So with that, let's go to Bruce McDonald, President and CEO of Imagine Canada, Sharon Avery, President and CEO of the Toronto Foundation, and Monica LaBarge, an assistant professor at the Smith School of Business at Queen's University. Hello and welcome to you all. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Libby.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Libby.
Okay, well, let's begin with Bruce. So have we reached peak Giving Tuesday? I mean, again, I feel like I'm inundated. And I bet a lot of people, other people do as well.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. I mean, I think whether we've reached peak probably depends on where you are in the country, as some organizations are getting going on the West Coast. But, you know, certainly it's a critically important time for the sector. You know, this is still really very much the season of giving in Canada, as, you know, about 40% of all individual donations come in the last sort of 6 to 8 weeks of the year. So it's natural for organizations to be taking advantage of this moment in time, this sort of focus on community rather than commercial interests, and are reaching out to folks in their networks.
Monica, when did charities or start to adopt, I think, the same kind of marketing strategies as for-profits? I mean, the Giving Tuesday, there's a lot of this matching offers. Your gift will go further. And frankly, I'm a little skeptical of those. I think that, you know, if there's some large donor or corporation that says, I'll give you 50, they'll give you 50 as matching, or they'll give you 50 another way. But I don't think that those dollars are going to be withdrawn if they aren't matched.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would have to depend a little bit on the agreement that that donor makes. But, you know, in terms of your first question, I would say that it started when they all when executive directors and marketing departments started coming to the same classes that we were using to teach everybody who works in a for-profit corporation. So they're using the same kinds of tools and tactics. And, you know, there is no special media or, you know, special tools for marketing for nonprofits. They're trying to break through the same clutter as everybody else. And so I think that's why we're seeing a lot of the same tactics, because, you know, as Bruce said, this is a really important time for them to get a lot of money that they need to be able to make their missions work over the rest of the year. And so I think that's why we see this intensive push for Giving Tuesday.
And I mean, does the idea of having a one day like Black Friday or Cyber Monday, which, by the way, my inbox tells me those sales are continuing, and they started early. Is that a good idea, or does it overwhelm people?
I mean, I think potentially, it started out as a good idea to try and shift the focus, I think, from consumerism to more community. But I do, there is a bit of a danger, I think, from my perspective, of making people think that you only need to give one day a year, when we know that actually it's a lot better for charities to have sustaining donations over the course of the year, and not have everything come in the last, you know, 6 or 8 weeks of the year, because that can be a pretty nail biting time for those boards and executive directors trying to see if they're going to have money to continue next year. So I think there is a little bit of a danger, but certainly if it raises awareness and spurs some people who haven't donated before to think about donating and to find a cause that they really believe in, then I think that's probably an upside.
Okay, let's bring in Sharon Avery. I am thinking that probably in your world, it doesn't all happen on Giving Tuesdays. Family decide to have a family fund or a single person's fund at a different time, and then they deploy it. So what's your take on all of this, watching this?
Well, I think that, honestly, charities are feeling what everyone else is feeling right now, the cost of living, the pressure of that. More people are turning to community organizations for help, and the stuff we're seeing, same, I imagine Bruce is seeing the same thing. We're seeing donations are on the decline in Canada. Volunteer hours are on the decline. And so they are as desperate as businesses are to make money. Our charitable sector is desperate to gain money. So I hear you, Libby, totally. And I would say on the matching front, what we often see is, the great thing about matching is, yes, they almost always give that gift, but we're all still humans. We still react to that match. And so you actually see an increase in giving when people are inspired by the match. However we feel about it, it does seem to drive returns. And goodness knows the charitable sector needs it. But I also agree with our friend at Queen's that we need giving year round, and certainly that's what we see. It is still a peak time for people setting up funds at Toronto Foundation and other community foundations across the country. It definitely, the last quarter of the year is where we see the most charitable activity happening. And so I think both that we do want it year round and that we need to accept that humans in Canada really actually feel the most charitable at this time of year, and we need to take it every chance that we can, because the sector is definitely struggling.
Okay, I have to say, my husband and I had a very lively debate about the matching thing shortly before I went on air, and he first of all was saying, no, my money's going to grow, I have to do it when it's matching. And then after making some phone calls, he came to me and said, I hate to say it, but you are right. So that's one thing. I'd like to hear from people about whether they are donating, if they're feeling the pinch, and whether they're making a point of donating today, if the possibility of matching money makes a difference. So let me give the numbers out again. This is a very interesting conversation. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And Bruce, I've seen some very almost conflicting numbers. So first of all, generationally, and this is kind of worrisome, so we know that people in our demographic and older demographic are tend to give more, but there was a new study by Canada Helps which said that 1 in 5 people between 18 and 35 have not given to charities in the last 5 years, if ever. And to me, that is a really worrisome trend, because it seems like it's not that they're not, you know, whatever is happening to them economically, it's they're not in the habit of doing it.
Yeah, I think what we're witnessing is a fundamental shift in the starting point for being a donor. So for young people today, their financial situation looks remarkably different from that of their parents or grandparents. It is really difficult to be a regular monthly mission-based donor or a donor of any kind when you're coming out of school with major amounts of student debt, when you're trying to find a place to live that's consuming a large portion of your paycheck, and when you work in an environment that has more contract-based work and less permanent work. So it's hard to plan to be a forward-looking donor. That's not to say that young people, though, are not generous. They're finding different ways to engage. But I think what's incumbent upon those of us in the charitable sector is to not view the participation of young people exclusively through a donor-based lens, but rather to say, how are we ensuring that younger folks are actually engaging with the causes? So at such time as they either come into wealth or they get a bit older and their earning power goes up, that they're not a lost generation of engaged citizens. Because I think it's the civic participation through time, talent, expertise, and eventually money that's really critical to ensure that we're nurturing the next generation of people who care about others in their neighborhood or their community.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if part of the problem is they show they care by posting stuff rather than doing stuff. Well, let's take a call from Dawn in Hamilton. Hi, Dawn.
Oh, hello, Libby. I'm just calling... So I'm still dithering about giving on, you know, Giving Tuesday, because I give year round. You know,
good for you.
It's better to do things in secret than to broadcast. But you know, I budget for giving monthly to a charity. There's other ways of giving though, volunteering. I mean, I don't volunteer a lot. I'm thinking about increasing my volunteer hours. I'm in a position where I can do that, and I'm healthy enough to do that. There's all sorts of considerations. But I want to encourage people that, you know, when you give to even, you're cleaning out your closet, you're giving your clothes away to a charity. People who are in need are able to take those clothes at a much reduced price. So you might not get a tax receipt or anything for it, But that is charity as well.
Or they're sold by the bushel. Don, I mean, you know, we're hearing about how hard it is for a lot of people, but again, you know, for when giving is spread out, I mean, if you give $7 or $10 a month, I mean, that's a latte, which, you know, I'm not saying people shouldn't treat themselves to a latte, but it also makes it easier to afford. Yeah. But thanks for your call and good for you for giving. And again, people, we have just a few minutes left in this segment. So if you want to call and tell us what you're doing, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And Monica, so Giving Tuesday started back in 2012, and last year was apparently a record, or was a nearly 25% increase at 16 million in a day. But the total for the year, it's like 12 billion is what I saw online, even though that does sound a little high. So what do you make of those numbers?
Well, I think that Giving Tuesday is a really nice opportunity to leverage, you know, talking about the matching piece, to leverage the social norms, or the sort of social broadcasting, I guess, of behavior, because like Don said, it's better to give in secret than to broadcast. And I'm not sure I agree. And I think that probably most charities would prefer that donors tell their friends and family, this is why I'm giving to this organization, this is why it's important to me. And so having the hashtag of Giving Tuesday, which is really how it started, is a day for those of us who do give and who do volunteer and do participate with nonprofits to say, hey, this is what I do and it's important to me and this is why I think you should do it too, because that may reach people that we'd never be able to reach using more conventional marketing methods, or who might not otherwise pay attention. And so I think that's why you see so much of a bump on this particular day, because it does leverage that we're all social animals, and you know, your husband was saying that he responds to those kinds of things. And so I think that's where the matching piece comes in. That's where the sharing piece comes in. And I actually do think it is a really great way for us all to show how we can be engaged in our communities in lots of different ways.
Okay, let's take a call from Jean in Palmerston. Hi, Jean.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Go ahead, Jean. You're on the air.
So in regards to Giving Tuesday, or the push right now to collect money, my husband and I are deeply involved in charitable functions. We host a Christmas dinner, an annual Christmas dinner for whoever needs it. We feed about 400 people. And
wow.
We take the proceeds from the donation jar and sponsor three community pantries now for people who have overused the food banks or can't access the food banks. I also belong to a group called 100 Women Who Care. And there's 117 women. We get together four times a year. Three people propose a charity, or they draw them out of a hat. And then we vote on the one we want, and they receive $10,000. So we're giving out $40,000. So the part I want to talk about is, when you donate that money through the 100 Women Who Care, you get a tax receipt. Well, that tax receipt clearly goes to the businesses or the charitable, because then they bombard you. And like I'm talking to them, I say, I'm driving home right now from delivering groceries to seniors who can't get out. We're doing the charitable dinner. I have 100 Women Who Care. I donate money constantly, and they just will not stop. They keep on going. So eventually their perseverance becomes fairly annoying.
Yeah. So
and it
yeah.
does not work in their favor. I'm sorry.
Well,
they need to listen to me. They say, well, thank you for what you're doing, but could you do more? No, I don't think I can do more than what we're doing right now. We're pretty engaged.
I hear you, and it's like with, again, it's the same thing you see in retail. Like, you make a donation, and then you'll get six more asks in a very short period of time.
Yes.
It's the same thing, I'm assuming, say, that the supermarket knows that I have a household of two, and if
right.
I buy a big thing of something perishable, I'm not going to want another one a day later. So
right.
I don't know.
And like, I appreciate it. And some of them are very appreciative. They said, wow. But if you do that, could you do this? I'm going, no, like we're going to feed 400 people at the end of the month.
Okay, Jean. Well, good for you.
Most of that.
Good for you, Jean. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Clayton in Richmond Hill. Hi, Clayton.
Hello, how are you? Charities do a wonderful thing. But when Post Canada went on strike, that cost a lot of mom and pop businesses, really to tank and go under. So, I mean, when you talk about donations as well, at least when you have a company that owns a 10-story complex, whether they lease it out to other people for, rent and stuff, but just to have a 10-story complex, which I will not name the company, it costs about $1 million a month. Heat, rent, the whole schmear, keeping it clean. So when you donate as much as $100,000 to a charity, whatever charity that is, you've got accountants, you have staff. My father was an internal federal tax officer. The accountants, how much money of that $100,000 is actually going to buy food? What I do is if I know someone who is hungry, I'll go and feed that person. I don't distinguish. I don't give it to a third party. I will go and do it direct. And I encourage people to do it direct to know where their money is going.
That's, that's how GoFundMe started. Clayton, thank you for your call. We're out of time on this. And by the way, charities do have to disclose where the money is going. And that's one of the things that people are encouraged to look at. How much is going to the actual cause and what's the impact? All of which takes some time and thought. People are really engaged in this. And we need the money. The times are tough, and you should think about where you want to donate your charitable dollars. And in the meantime, thanks so much, Bruce McDonald, Monica LaBarge, and who else is with me? It's Sharon Avery. Sorry about that, Sharon.
That's okay.
Thanks, and I hope that you continue to have a good season. As you pointed out, 40% of all charitable donations are coming at the end of the year. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, we're taking another break. When we come back, terrible news this morning. A garbage worker killed by his own truck. And it brings to mind some of the dangers of these huge vehicles operating that probably cannot see people walking, cycling, or even in smaller vehicles when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Well, terrible news this morning. A garbage truck operator has died after he was struck by the truck he was working on in Scarborough. Authorities are investigating. There's no clarity on what happened, but I want to talk about the dangers of large vehicles like garbage trucks, cement trucks, whatnot, and the dangers they pose to pedestrians, cyclists, and even the drivers of smaller cars. I myself had a very scary experience just yesterday. The numbers 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. We don't have a lot of time, but let us go to Dylan Reed, the founder of Walk Toronto. Hi, Dylan.
Hi there.
So I think this is kind of an increasing danger, these huge vehicles, and you wonder what they can see and what they can't see in terms of a pedestrian or even someone in a smaller car.
Absolutely. This is one of the issues that we've been working on for many years now. big trucks are one of the biggest dangers for pedestrians and cyclists. They're dangerous because first of all, exactly as you say, they don't have good visibility. The drivers can't always see everything around them. And secondly, because they're often raised up, they tend to drag pedestrians and cyclists under the truck. So we've been trying to fight for years to get the federal government to require side guards on trucks so that if a pedestrian cyclist is hit by a truck, by the side of a truck, they'll get knocked over onto the sidewalk as opposed to being dragged under the truck. And Mayor Olivia Chow did introduce a requirement that city vehicles begin to add side guards, but of course, you know, her jurisdiction is limited. So there's still a lot of these dangerous trucks out there. In Europe, a lot of trucks now have much better windows so that they have visibility, kind of wraparound visibility, but those standards aren't here in North America.
Yeah, I mean, I had a very scary experience just yesterday. There were two, I think, cement trucks. They weren't moving. I was on a side street facing each other. They were kind of parked, or they were not moving. And I'm driving in the right lane I was supposed to be in. And suddenly one of them starts, you know, coming for me and clear. I mean, I don't think he did it on purpose. So, had to swerve out of the way, but it's really, really scary. You know, when you're in a big vehicle like that, I mean, presumably they're focused on whatever job they're doing and, they're protected.
Yeah. I mean, there's been, certainly near where I live, I think there's been at least one, maybe more than one fatality because of the, Ontario Line construction trucks, and they're supposed to be following very specific routes, but sometimes they don't. And there's at least a couple of pedestrians that have been killed or seriously injured by being caught under those trucks.
You know, we're going to have to pick up this conversation, but before we go, what advice do you have for pedestrians? Like, just steer clear?
Yeah, for pedestrians and cyclists, like, do not try to get too close, especially when they're turning right. They don't see very well. And you can easily get caught. So definitely for pedestrians and cyclists, do not get stuck beside a truck. But really, like, you know, it shouldn't be up to it. If we're on the sidewalk, we should be safe. If cyclists are in a bike lane, they should be safe. So we really need the federal government to step up and, you know, think about some better regulations.
Well, and our condolences to the family and friends of this worker. And we still don't know the details of how that happened, but just awful. But also a note of caution for the rest of us. Thanks so much, Dylan Reed.
Well, thank you for it. Thanks a lot.
Okay. That's all the time we have for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today. Coming up tomorrow, we have a lot of medical news in the medical panel and also a closer look at what came out in that Auditor General's report. And, you know, people, it's Giving Tuesday today, but as we said, it's the whole season. And if you couldn't get through today to talk about how and what you like to donate to, Free for All Friday is coming up. And that's all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.